This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and it's Friday. So how about we jump right into our Week in Review? The city continues to try to address the growing humanitarian crisis unfolding around the area of Mass and Cass, including a plan to use 30 rooms at the Quality Inn Hotel in Revere as transitional housing, while Revere Mayor Brian Arrigo is skeptical that the city of Boston has done the legwork.
I have no confidence that the Boston Public Health Commission took any of those steps or can do any of those steps.
Arrigo isn't the only Massachusetts public official raising alarms this week. In a separate issue, more than a dozen local elected officials spoke out against the Biden administration's treatment of Haitian immigrants seeking shelter in the U.S., something the White House says it is investigating.
There is an investigation the president certainly supports, overseen by the Department of Homeland Security.
Is that enough? Marie St. Fleur, former Massachusetts state representative and the first Haitian American elected to state office in the country, is not convinced.
Until I see real action, I'm skeptical.
Meanwhile, 11 cities and towns across the state held preliminary elections this week. One of them, Fall River, also trying to shake off the ghosts of the past as a former mayor is sentenced to 6 years in prison.
It is a chapter that the people in Fall River just desperately want to move on from because it's been sticking around for so long.
And all of that in the midst of the ongoing pandemic, with debates and lawsuits still ongoing over mask and vaccine mandates, even as medical experts say vaccines are still the best path back to some kind of new normal.
We want to be in a place where this virus is like a common cold or flu and we can live with it.
We also heard there from Tim White of WPRI in Rhode Island and Dr. Shira Durone with Tufts Medical Center. And that's where we're going to start, with the pandemic. Do you now qualify for a booster after announcements this week? If you do you plan to get one? If you don't qualify, jealous, happy to wait? How do you feel about that? What to make of the lawsuits to stop mandates, both vaccines and masks? And when a place like TD Garden says you have to be vaccinated to get in, does it make you more or less likely to go there? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation with our panelists. And who are they this week? Well, I'm glad you asked. We have Joe Battenfeld, political columnist for the Boston Herald, and Tito Jackson, former Boston City Councilor, former Boston mayoral candidate, and now CEO of Verdant Medical. Tito, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Joe, welcome back to you, too.
Thanks, Tiziana.
And Joe, I don't think I'm ever going to be able to say the phrase political columnist without having a little trouble tripping
<That's>
it. All right, so let's go in on COVID here, folks. We have got lawsuits, we've got mandates, we've got boosters. There's so much, but I think I have to start with hometown Dr. Rochelle Walensky, head of the CDC, shocking a whole lot of people today when she overruled her advisory panel and included healthcare workers and other high-risk jobs as eligible for boosters. Scott Gottlieb, the former FDA commissioner, weighed in on her right to do that. Here he is.
The CDC director is well within her discretion. The bottom line is the ACIP committee is just providing advice to CDC. It's very explicit that the CDC director retains the ultimate authority. And if you remember, there were some tweaks made to the original recommendation around the administration of the vaccine back in December.
So much ado about nothing, Joe, that she sort of stepped ahead of the advisory panel there, or is that her purview?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it is her purview, but it makes things very confusing for the average person out there who's getting advice from the CDC, from somebody else, from President Biden, and, you know, they all seem to conflict. And, you know, the Biden administration jumped ahead of this whole thing, initially the whole booster debate, by saying people should get boosters, and then all of a sudden it's like, no, only people 65 or older to get boosters. So I think it's very confusing for people, and they need to do a better job of messaging.
So, Tito, I want to think about that confusing thing for just a minute, and I'm going to play some sound that came from Ask the Doctors here on Tuesday. So a listener tweeted about how after getting the J&J vaccine and hearing no updates all summer about a booster for J&J, they ended up getting a Pfizer one dose. They went out on their own and did that. Now, our doctors, Dr. Philip Landrigan of Boston College and Dr. Shira Durone of Tufts Medical Center, had opposite reactions to that.
It sounds to me like that person is well protected and they should get on with their life.
I really advise people to follow what the CDC's Advisory Council on Immunization Practice recommends. They spend days talking about all of the data and deciding what is in the best interest of Americans, and I would follow that.
Tito, that kind of feels like a Rorschach test. You listen to one or the other depending on what you want.
Yeah, I see the sheep. No, but I think in this situation, I think the thing that is consistent is that we need to make sure that people are vaccinated. Now, this conversation as to whether or not you should have two doses or an additional dose, I think that's kind of the advanced placement component here. But the underlying issue is that people need to get vaccinated. I was down in Florida, and I visited my mom and my sister, and my sister's church, it's called Impact, amazing church. They did on-site vaccinations at that church, but they lost 7 people in 1 week. Mm. And all of them were under the age of 35, and all but one of them was under the age of 35, and none of them were vaccinated. So the real underlying issue that we know here is that most of the people who are getting very sick, and I again, COVID was horrible for me, but I had the Delta variant's little brother. And so when it comes to what needs to happen, we need to still make sure that those people who are unvaccinated do get vaccinated as folks work this out. I would say, obviously, people who are in the hospital, particularly in the respiratory department or ER department, are being exposed more. And I think the CDC director has, under her purview, the opportunity to say whether or not those individuals deserve a booster shot or not.
So, Tito, you stuck me in my tracks saying, you know, I remember you talking about how hard your bout of COVID hit you. And for you to say that that's Delta's little brother is saying something. I'm going to go to the phones here, 800-423-8255. We've got Jessica on the line in Andover. Jessica, go ahead.
Hi there, Tiziana. Thank you for taking my call. I was sadly a victim of COVID more than a year ago, almost 2 years ago, when it was first on the horizon here in the United States. I subsequently got vaccinated when I was eligible. I am now becoming eligible for the booster and fully intend on getting my Pfizer booster. And in terms of people having thoughts about we shouldn't do it yet or there needs to be more research, I think that what we've already seen is that it is effective and it's...
Oh, we lost Jessica, but not without getting an effective testimony from her about the efficacy of boosters. Joe Battenfeld, I'm going to turn back to you because with this move by the CDC, it could include not only older adults, but healthcare workers. To put that in perspective here, 2020 census numbers say that more than 17% of all residents in Massachusetts are over the age of 65, so more than 1 million people. And according to the Boston Indicators Project, roughly 800,000 frontline workers in the Commonwealth, and more than half of those are in healthcare. So this is a big deal for the Commonwealth, but can we get the shots into arms?
Yeah, that's the question. It is a big chunk of people, but it's not as many as got vaccinated, obviously, initially. And there was an initial, like I said, there was an initial guidance that everyone should get a booster shot after like 5 or 6 months, and then that changed. So people may be a little unsure as to whether they should get those. And now they may try to get them, and the government is like, no, you can't get them because you're not 65 or you're not a healthcare worker. But it is good that we're getting more secondary shots into people's arms. I think they should go for more people myself.
You think that you just open the doors?
I think they should open the doors, and I think that we have enough vaccine, and I think that, you know, that's what the makers of the vaccine say. We have advice from them saying people should get boosters right away.
I'm going to grab a call here, 1-800-423-8255. We've got Greg on the line in Cambridge. Greg, go ahead.
Hey, it seems to me that we're conflating a whole bunch of different issues that leading to a lot of our confusion. We need the FDA to tell us what is the safe and effective dose of the vaccine for anyone, and that's independent of who, what, when, where, why, or how. That's a scientific and objective question that the FDA needs to be answering for us. We then need to be looking to the CDC to say, okay,
who in our population does this apply to? And then finally, the question of what is our geopolitical responsibility to developing nations is an entirely separate question, regardless of how important it is, from what is the safe and effective dose of the vaccine.
Greg, we're starting to lose your sound, but that is a really helpful point, and I'm going to pick up on your argument for keeping it clean. The FDA says, here's the dose. The CDC says, who gets it? And then there are other bodies that say, what is America's role in the world in this landscape? Tito, I'm going to add some sound to that and turn to you, because Dr. Shira Doron, Tufts Medical Center, asked the doctors on Tuesday, wanted to actually take the focus a little bit off of sort of vaccines as the holy grail and begin to focus also on a level of comfort with lower level COVID infections. Here she is.
We want to be in a place where this virus is like a common cold or flu and we can live with it. And that's what immunity will do. Widespread immunity will make it so that the virus is still circulating, but we're okay with it because we're not getting very sick from it.
So not to overstate it, she's still saying boosters, right? But with an emphasis on getting this to a place where it's like the common cold. And how do you put that against the geopolitical landscape, for example, Tito?
I think she, you know, that is where all of us would like to be. But in the meantime, and I agree with Joe on this piece around, we need to be thoughtful and deliberate and act quickly on folks getting the medicine that they need. One other point that's actually really critical is that the federal government needs to get out of their own way relative to getting doses that are not currently being used in our state and multiple other states, and allowing those to be shipped to other countries. So there are tens of thousands of doses that are now sitting in refrigerators that are actually going to expire. And based on FDA, CDC, and speaking of geopolitical stuff, I'll call it that, that they are not, well, they're precluded from being able to ship these life-saving doses out to other places that could actually use them. So that's one of the other pieces that we need to be thinking about.
So, Joe Battenfeld, I am struck by, and I think I'm going to use the word juxtaposition like 700 times in the show today. So here's number one. I am struck by the juxtaposition of this concern about having enough vaccines globally and something like the union representing state troopers fighting a mandate for vaccines from Governor Baker saying you can't make us do this, while you've got a group like the World Health Organization saying we need access to vaccines elsewhere. Square that circle.
Yeah, I mean, it is a difficult problem, I think, and, you know, getting enough vaccine to other countries. And we seem to be doing an okay job here in the United States where, as far as supply goes, but we don't seem to be doing a great job as far as other countries go in getting that vaccine to people. It's certainly available. Some countries have done a good job, but others have not. So until we sort of make this a global issue, and this should be a global issue, not just a United States issue, and we should be taking care of other countries that need it.
So, Tito, I'm going to stick on these lawsuits for a minute because I've been thinking about them. So we have the lawsuit from state troopers, and that was the State Police Association of Massachusetts. A Superior Court judge denied the injunction they were requesting on Governor Baker's vaccine mandate for public workers in order to give them time to negotiate under collective bargaining. Then you got parents in Tewksbury who sued the Department of Elementary and Secondary Education and the Tewksbury School District this week over a school mask mandate there. And I, just to kind of put that one in context, they're suing to stop a school mask mandate against the fact that more than 2,000 students tested positive for COVID in the Massachusetts schools last week. Now, that is 0.2% of the population. So it seems like the data, the 0.2% part, show masks work. But the data, the 2,000 part, show masks are necessary. So what is the message to these groups who are suing to stop prevention?
Cut it out. I would, you know, in Miami, when they opened their schools, in the first week, 13 teachers died. This is still an illness that can kill people. And also, in the long-term aspects of COVID, it can do very harmful things to your body. And in particular, those who are in our emergency services, like our police officers and state troopers, we want you to be safe. And so in all other aspects of your job, radios, body cameras, protective gear, bulletproof vests, and the like, we want you to have the best, and we also want you to have it first because you're the first, you're first responders. So this, I think folks need to really think about it. And for those 2,000 folks who did get sick, it does not seem like a large number, but as one who actually did get sick, that one person, it can't hurt. It can hurt your body, and it can give you long-term effects. And so let's all work together and do the right thing.
So, Joe, before we go to a new subject, I want to pick up one more thread here, which is the move by the TD Garden announcing that you have to have proof of vaccination or a negative test for admission to events there. That includes Bruins and Celtics games. And I want to ask, is this important because it's another major local institution making the choice? Or is there something extra in the fact that it is the TD Garden and this is Bruins and Celtics games and Bruins and Celtics fans?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's hugely important. It sends a signal to people and to other companies that, you know, we need to, they have every right to have a vaccine mandate to determine who gets into their events. So I support them. And I think that more companies should be doing this and educating people as well as to, there should be a public education campaign going on too, as far as why we need this, just so you don't shove it in people's faces so they actually understand why the TD Garden is doing this. But I think it's a symbolic move that could have repercussions to other businesses.
We are in it this week with former Boston City Councilor Tito Jackson and Joe Battenfeld, a columnist for the Boston Herald. We're going to talk about local politics now, and there's a lot to talk about, and this is wheelhouse for our panelists, so this is going to be fun, folks. Did your town go to the polls in a preliminary this week? Tell us about it. What were the big candidates in your community? What were the big issues? What do you make of the sentencing of Jaisal Correa, former mayor of Fall River, especially on the day that that city went to a preliminary election? And how about the move by Boston mayoral candidate Anissa Sibe George to distance herself from a super PAC associated with former President Donald Trump? Is it time to get outside money out of these local races? 800-423-8255 to join the conversation. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Okay, so Joe, Tito, I think let's start with the 11 additional cities and towns that held preliminary elections this week. It was sort of like preliminary, the sequel. One thing about I love about, you know, local news is we get to really lean into this wonkiness. So I want to ask you, Tito, any race in particular that you followed this week?
I actually followed the Everett race. There was a young lady named Girlie Adrian, a young person running out of Everett, who mounted a laudable challenge in that election. She came up short. But I do want to give her props. I think it's really interesting, and particularly when you see people of color who are running in cities outside of the city of Boston. So I give her props for that.
And she had an interesting story in that she served, and I apologize that I don't remember off the top of my head if it was city council or school committee. City council,
City council, yep. Mm-hmm.
And locked horns. She was a black member of the city council in a white city council, and there were a lot of tensions during COVID, and she locked horns with members of the council, including her opponent in the race, correct?
Yes, many times, and in particular around issues of policing, as well as COVID policy. And she stood very strong, and I'm just very impressed by the work that she's been able to do. And I think you will be hearing her name again in the future. But I think this is kind of my Christmas. Because this is the time of the year where the elections that I believe matter most in our lives actually happen, which are the elections that happen on a municipal level.
Well, merry electoral Christmas to you then, Tito.
Thank you.
And she did not make it out of the preliminary, is that correct?
No, she did not.
Yeah. All right. So, Joe, what were you watching this week? Anything catch your attention?
I think the thing that caught my attention, not just one particular community or city, but how there seemed to be a lot of outsiders and first-time candidates that were getting involved in politics or trying to get involved in politics. I don't know if they all won or not, but it seemed to be a common thread that, you know, especially progressives were getting in these races. And I don't know how they all fared, but I think it's a good sign that more people are willing to run for office, even in the preliminary election. The other thing that caught my attention was the dismal turnout, and not just in Boston, but in other cities as well. It was really disappointing to see that.
So I want to pick up turnout again a little bit later. So let's mark that one. I want to stay in the local races for a minute and add another nominee, which was Lawrence. I found Lawrence really interesting because I feel like it underscores how important mayors can be. Now, we've learned that during the pandemic, but former Lawrence Mayor Dan Rivera, I think, showed that earlier. Stepped down in January to run the state's development arm, Mass Development. He had made a significant mark there through turnaround work in the school and as the leader in the community during the Merrimack Valley gas explosion. A lot of really core meat and potato issues in Lawrence. Here is reporter Simone Rios from WBUR, who covered the races, telling us about the Lawrence issues earlier this week.
Like other gateway cities, Lawrence has been hit really hard by the coronavirus. Then, of course, people are concerned about the lack of housing in the city. I've talked to a city councilor who told me that because of gentrification happening and displacement in neighboring cities, rents that were just $800 2 years ago are now in the $1,300, $1,400 range.
And then you've actually got the opposite of what Joe was just saying. Rather than newcomers, you've got an acting mayor running against a former mayor, that's Kendris Vasquez and William Lantigua, to replace the stepped-away mayor. Really, really fascinating. Tito, what to make of all of that?
Well, I think, and props to my friend Dan Rivera, who is doing a great job at the state. But also, I think the other pieces are really these local mayor races. In many cases, and we'll talk a little bit more about Fall River, but can inject credibility and enthusiasm and excitement back into the local politics. And Lawrence has had a great deal of struggle over many years, and I think it's really important that there's great leadership there. I think the other piece that is also apparent is Boston's issues overflow onto other cities and towns. And so what you're dealing with in the city of Boston with upward pressure and rents and housing prices, all of the cities and towns around them, even out to Lawrence and Haverhill and even into other states are pushing people further and further from the city of Boston. So I think that's the other component that's critical, is that we have a regional economy, and what happens in the city of Boston has an inordinate effect around the cities and towns around the city.
1-800-423-8255. Pick up on Tito Jackson's thread there. Are our cities and towns having shared issues? Is this an opportunity to understand that across the Commonwealth we are facing the same challenges, and across the Commonwealth we could create shared solutions? So you listeners weigh in on that. Joe Battenfeld, maybe you can weigh in on that.
Yeah, housing especially, it was the biggest issue, I think, in a lot of these cities outside in Boston as well as outside Boston, because they're, like Tito said, they're getting hit by rent increases just like Boston has, and it's sort of filtering outside the city now, and they have a short supply of affordable housing. There's just not enough for people, and people are getting squeezed out, and it's very disheartening to see.
I do want to go back and note, by the way, I mentioned that race in Lawrence and I didn't tell you what happened. Kendris Vasquez did go on to the final and William Lantigua did not. All right. So a minute ago, we talked about turnout. I want to play a piece of sound. Okay. So we had John Barros on yesterday to reflect on his race in Boston. Of course, he lost in the preliminary last week. One of the things that we talked about was turnout. And he basically said maybe the candidate pool was too good. Here he is.
Well, you know what I heard too often was, oh, great candidates. And, you know, almost like any one of you can be mayor. Kind of like what you just said.
Right? Fair enough.
Like, I felt like we needed like someone who people were scared to, you know, elect.
And in all fairness to John, I had said any one of them could be mayor. So he was riffing off what I had just said. You know, let's turn that on its head. An embarrassment of riches. Do we have a Commonwealth where great people who are talented and capable really want to step up and lead in our communities, Joe?
In some cases we do, but I think in some case we had candidates also. You can turn it, flip it around and say, why didn't more people turn out to vote? Was it the candidate's fault? Did they not energize people and get people excited to turn out? Because that's their job, is to energize people and get the vote out, and it didn't seem to work. Even Michelle Wu was pretty much the only one who was able to, you know, get her base out. And the others had trouble, and, you know, Asai B. George as well, in her limited districts, you know, in her limited wards where she did well, she got the turnout in. But across the city, it was pretty disappointing to see. So I don't, you know, I blame the candidates for that.
Tito, do you agree? So across the Commonwealth, what would it take between now and that Tuesday in November to drive enthusiastic voter turnout in the cities and towns in Massachusetts?
Folks need to get out and actually, you know, I know a lot of money got spent on TV and obviously we're on radio right now. But when it comes down to where dollars are being spent, I think one of the misses here is real grassroots campaigning. Actually getting folks on the ground, having real knock and drag tactics to actually pull people out and really organizing on a precinct by precinct level. I don't believe that we saw as much of that as we needed to see. Even in a world where Facebook and Instagram and Twitter and all of those things exist, it is still exceptional and notable for someone to come to your door and ask you for support. And I don't think we're going to get away from that in New England anytime soon.
So I'm thinking about juxtaposing, encouraging people to get out and vote against the tough times that we have in politics sometimes. And Tito, you said a minute ago, we'll probably get to Fall River, and we're going to get to that now. And I do want to put this out to listeners, 1-800-423-8255. What did you make of the sentencing of former Mayor Jaisal Correa out of Fall River? 6 years ultimately was the sentence. And to many people's surprise, the judge actually overturned some of the jury verdicts prior to doing that sentencing. I'm going to play a little bit of sound here from a conversation we had with WRPI's Tim White. This was Tuesday, talking out of Rhode Island, talking to us about the long controversial past that Correa had and its overall impact on Fall River politics.
Even then, when he got into office, there was a lot of turmoil with the two mayors prior to him when he was on the city council, a Mayor Flanagan. So there's been a political disturbance in the force, if you will, in Fall River for quite some time.
Well, other than us quoting political disturbance in the force in the back rooms of WBUR for the rest of the week after that, Joe, what kind of impact does that have on a community?
I think it creates the perception, you know, that politicians are crooked and that people are distrustful of them. And it sort of feeds into that narrative when you have a mayor being sentenced, you know, on corruption charges like that. It really hurts, I think, you know, it causes people to say, oh, just politicians acting like politicians again. And, you know, obviously this is only one person we're talking about here, but it happens enough throughout the state that people get discouraged about that, I think, and that might lead to some poor voter turnout as well.
Tito, I heard you say mm-hmm, so I'm just going to let you jump right in.
Well, Joe, spot on. Negative campaigning has actually data shows that contracts the vote, but having someone just disrespect and dishonor the office and the manner in which this happened is chilling. And I do believe he is going to have to, you know, serve his time. I really look forward to strong leadership coming out of Fall River to right the record and right the wrongs that have been done. it should not be the expectation that people are taking, you know, money on the side or gaming the system or the like. So I think it is one of the most disgraceful things that one can do, in particular in this case. So I think it is important that there is an example that is made of him, and obviously the judge did that.
So let's stay on that for just one more question, Joe. To that point, an example was made, as Tito said. So Jaisal Correa goes to jail for 6 years. He's incarcerated for 6 years, although I will say that Tim White, who'd been following the story very closely, was surprised by that number and thought it was low. It was predominantly because of the convictions around extortion around marijuana shops locally. But now comes sentencing and time, jail time, incarceration time. In the end, then, are we shaken in our faith in local leaders, as you say, because of corruption? Or are we restored in our faith in local leaders because corruption was answered with successful prosecution?
I think shaken is the...
Man.
I know, I'm sorry. But I just think that people see these kind of things. Like Tito said, it has a chilling effect on politics and... Correa is very lucky that he only got 6 years. He was lucky that the judge threw out some other charges against him, or he would have gotten much more. And I don't think 6 years was enough for what he did. But, that's the way the law goes. And people, you know, might have expected that he would get even more jail time than that. But unfortunately, I just don't think, you know, just because it was a successful prosecution, there will be others down the line.
And to point out what you said, Joe, the judge overturned 8 of the 21 findings by the jury. All right, we've got a call on line 800-423-8255. Steve is calling from Bedford. Steve, go ahead.
Hi. I just want to comment that in high school, I took a mandatory course on civics this whole semester, so I learned a whole lot about how governments work, local, state, federal. As an adult, I took a course in citizenship in Lexington. My wife took the course too. And again, we learned how local government works, the importance and consequences of, you know, importance of voting or not voting and the consequences, and just how government works, how to petition, learned so much. But, you know, I'm a veteran, and even when I was overseas, I always voted, and no matter what happened, I always voted because I knew that's the way that I, as an American citizen, would exercise democracy. That's, if I believe in democracy, then I should vote. And so I encourage people to take a civics course, to study civics, study the U.S. Constitution, and understand why it's so important for us to exercise our rights, because if you don't exercise them, sooner or later they'll go away.
Thank you, Steve. So I think last word from Steve there on sort of the cradle-to-grave way that we need to engage. I do have one other subject I want to get to here on local politics, but Tito, I think I heard an mm-hmm again, so let me just give you a chance to react to Steve.
The thing I want to compliment Steve about is that we should have mandatory civics in all of our schools. We don't have that now. And it is absolutely critical if we want folks to participate, we want them to understand what they are participating in. And I also do want to thank Steve for his service to our country. And thank you for voting. And my name is Tito with two T's.
And sorry, Tito, you threw me with the spelling thing. I'm like, wait, have I been spelling his name wrong this entire time?
No.
Joe, anything you want to add there?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Tito that, you know, compliment people on voting, I wish people would understand that these municipal elections where we have such a dismal turnout, these are the ones where you actually should turn out and you can make the most difference. We had a city council election decided a couple years ago by one vote. So these are the elections that really matter and really have the most impact on people's lives.
Okay, before we shift gears again, there's one more thing. It is global politics, right? Global and local. And I, honest to God, I mostly just want to talk about this one because she just gave us such a passionate argument yesterday. I'm thinking of former State Representative Marie St. Fleur, who joined us yesterday. She's a regular on Week in Review here. She was the first Haitian American elected to state office in the U.S. We talked with her about the Biden administration's approach to Haitians who are seeking refuge in the United States. She expressed outrage over their approach. Here she is.
And anyone who is pro-life, who believes in humanity, should be outraged, you know, that human beings are being treated once again like cattle under the banner of the United States Constitution.
Tito, third largest Haitian population in the United States is here in Greater Boston. After the earthquake in 2010, the whole Greater Boston community organized, rallied, and supported our Haitian neighbors and Haitians in country who were suffering. What should we be doing here in Boston in face of this crisis?
We should be demanding that the Biden administration do the right thing. And I know the word was tossed around before a while back. This is deplorable. And I would submit that it's definitely criminal in terms of, you know, how these individuals are being treated. And to think about two natural disasters in 2 weeks that Haiti faced recently. And people are coming here, give us your tired and you're poor. You know, we are not living up to who we are as a country. And this is 2021, not 1921 or 1821. And when I see white men on horses whipping black people and on the U.S. Payroll, it gives me shivers. And so we have to step this up. And by the way, we have to call out the Biden administration, who is complicit in what's going on, and they absolutely need to immediately address this. And I believe that TPS should be extended to the Haitians who are having these issues at this point. They are our brothers and sisters.
TPS being temporary protected status. So Joe, Tito called it criminal yesterday. Marie called it assault and battery by border officers. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said at a press briefing that the White House is looking into this situation. Here she is.
There is an investigation the president certainly supports, overseen by the Department of Homeland Security, which he has conveyed will happen quickly. I can also convey to you that the secretary also conveyed to civil rights leaders earlier this morning that we would no longer be using horses in Del Rio. So that is something, a policy change that has been made in response.
Jen Psaki, sorry, I knew it was wrong the minute it came out of my mouth. Joe, reaction to that, is that enough? Is it even close to enough?
No, I mean, what kind of investigation do we need? We saw firsthand what was going on. We know what's going on. And I just think it's a terrible tragedy on a number of fronts, what's going on with the Haitian refugees. And we should be welcoming, as long as they are, you know, above board and real refugees really need asylum, we should be trying to welcome people into the country. And I know it's a difficult thing to do, but it's the right thing to do. And I think, interesting politically, I wish more Democrats like Tito were speaking out against the Biden administration on this. There's been some silence from some people that, you know, people like Ayanna Pressley have been speaking out, and Tito and some others, but among the leadership, they haven't.
Now let's talk about a clash between a couple of mayors, acting Boston Mayor Kim Janey and Revere Mayor Brian Arrigo. They go head-to-head over 30 hotel beds for those experiencing substance use disorder and homelessness in the Mass-and-Cass area of Boston. Do you think Mayor Arrigo did the right thing in pushing back on the city of Boston? How do we get cities and towns to coordinate on an issue that hurts families everywhere, but the manifestation of it is so locally concentrated in one neighborhood in Boston? How do we make progress on this gnarly, gnarly problem? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. So I'm going to play some sound right off the bat from Revere Mayor Brian Arrigo. We talked to him earlier this week after he sent a letter protesting the choice by the city of Boston to try to use 30 hotel rooms at the Quality Inn in Revere as transitional supportive housing, basically, for those at the intersection of Massachusetts Avenue and Melnia Cass Boulevard.
So we had heard everything from 160 to 30. And it depended on who we were talking to, we got different numbers. And
is 30 more attractive, assuming?
Well, what we want to make sure is that there's an operational plan, right? We want to make sure that there are other regional partners that are part of this, that there are state stakeholders that are part of this, that this isn't just something where putting 30 beds in one place and that's it.
So to that point, Tito Jackson, Mayor Janey, acting Boston Mayor Kim Janey, came back and said, it's been 30 beds, and we have been talking to the city of Revere for the last 3 weeks. So how are you watching this? What do you think the issue is? How are you reacting to Brian Arrigo's move?
Yeah, so these are two friends. Kim Janey's a friend, and Brian Arrigo's a friend.
And you endorsed Kim Janey in the Boston race.
Yes, I did. So, one, we need to note how we got here. So several things happened. The confluence, the Walsh administration, sadly, and without notice, shut down the bridge. So we need to
know. Long Island Bridge in 2014.
The Long Island Bridge. In addition, the Walsh administration closed the city-run methadone clinic that used to be on Frontage Road. All of those folks are now on Bragdon Street. So one of the things that we need to be thinking about that would potentially be one of the solutions is a state law needs to be passed that ensures there's some type of buffer zone for methadone clinics. Turns out in the city of Boston, there's a half a mile buffer zone for the industry that I'm in, the cannabis industry. But there's no buffer zone for methadone clinics. So there are five methadone clinics that are in that area. And how methadone clinics work is they get $10 a day per person, usually get 1,000 people, so that's $3.65 million. They come every single day, and then they get a couple of $100 a month for people to do urine analysis. So there's a lot of money in this. So what I would say to Mayor Arrigo, it's not for us to say I'm not in my backyard, but it can't all be in the backyard of Boston. And the last thing I would say is that there are when I left, and that this used to be part of my district, and then it shifted over to Frank Baker. When I left, the number of arrests or the percentage of arrests of people who were from outside of the city of Boston was far above 50%. Most of the people who get arrested in that area are not residents of Boston. So Boston cannot shoulder all of the burden here, and we should have a regional agenda in terms of dealing with this issue. And we have to work together, and I believe mayors in this corridor have to all work together.
So Joe Battenfeld, I'm going to turn to you for a word on this, but I'm going to add a voice first from the business owner perspective. Catherine D'Amato is the president and CEO of Greater Boston Food Bank, which sits in the Newmarket Business District. We had her on yesterday talking to us about what they have faced there and the cost they have incurred to increase security and address conditions there.
So we now have five security guards. That's about $550,000 annually, three during the day and two overnight. And then we have also had to put up new steel fencing because the other fencing was destroyed. So we've spent another $500,000 to do that. So it's you know,
that's $1 million, Catherine.
That's $1 million, and we can provide two meals for a dollar. So that's a million meals.
And she misspoke there, of course, two meals per dollar would be 2 million meals. So, Joe, just briefly, we are talking about impact, as Tito pointed out, that expands well beyond just the people at the intersection. What is the first next step in this urgent situation?
I think, you know, they need to convene some kind of meeting with these business owners to figure out what to do, because the Globe did an excellent piece on this, talking to businesses around Mass and Cass and how they are affected. You know, it's stunning. It's stunning to see, you know, just what we heard there. And all, you know, when we got the food bank and from other businesses, what they're spending on security, the dangers, the threats, you know, how dangerous it is. They have to be accompanied to their cars. Some businesses have to be people because it's so dangerous. I mean, there's a huge problem here, and that's mushrooming out far beyond just Mass and Cass. It's a whole section of the city that it's affecting. And it used to be a thriving business industrial area, you know, and unfortunately it's not safe anymore. And, you know, they're maybe to convene some kind of meeting with the business owners to figure out what to do, because they shouldn't be having to pay these costs.
So last note on that, and I'm going to take us to our hubbubs. We are going to continue to cover this. In fact, we're planning to do more coverage on the intersection of Mass and Cass on Radio Boston. And so I'm just going to plant a seed for future conversations, that there's a lot of chatter now about whether the state needs to step in and have its own role in, you know, trying to coordinate. All right, so we're going to leave that there, because we do like to leave time for hubbubs, which are those local stories that caught our attention this week. Tito Jackson, do you have a hubbub?
My neighbor won the District 7 City Council preliminary. Her name is Tanya Anderson, and I think it's pretty cool that the person who lives across the street from me won.
Oh, that's fantastic. Now that, okay, folks, that's how you do a truly local hubbub. If it is across the street from you, that's a local hubbub. All right, Joe Battenfeld. Sorry, Tito, go ahead.
I tried to go to Joe's house, but, you know, Joe didn't want to run. He just wanted to continue to do this, the political writing thing. So
there you go. Just criticize, yeah.
There you go. Okay, so, Joe, I think yours is a harder.
A little more serious one, yeah. Today, this month, is Suicide Prevention Awareness Month. And this is a problem, especially in COVID now, that's causing incredible harm throughout our country. And people should be made aware of that, you know, especially, you know, it affects like 20% of high school students have had serious thoughts of suicide, according to this research. 47% of lesbian, gay, and bisexual high school students have had thoughts of serious suicides. And that's the group that's being affected really the most in all this. And we should be doing something to help people more, to help people and make people aware.
All right. And so to that point, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline number, should you need it or someone you love is considering self-harm, that number is 1-800-273-8255. That's 1-800-273-8255. That line is available 24 hours a day and offers support in both English and Spanish. So I'm going to try to close this with a little bit of sort of prickly warm fuzzy with lions, tigers, and gorillas. I know you wanted me to say bears, but it's gorillas, and they will be vaccinated through Zoo New England for COVID-19. It turns out that the animals at both Franklin Park and Stone Zoos will be, because lions, tigers, and gorillas can be susceptible. So I think the lines to get vaccinated by the lions, tigers, and gorillas could be a fascinating thing, and we're going to have someone from Zoo New England join us next week to talk about more of it. But for now, I got to end a show here. So Joe Battenfeld, political columnist for the Boston Herald, Tito Jackson, former Boston City Councilor and CEO of Verdant Medical. Joe, thank you.
Thank you, Tiziana.
Tito, thanks so much.
Thank you, Tiziana.
And that's our show for today, folks. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Walter Wuthman, Amanda Beland, and Cynthia Betubiza. Marquise Neal is our technical director. We had engineering help today from Patrick O'Connor. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering. You are great. Thanks for listening. Have a good weekend and join us again on Monday for more Radio Boston.